Last time on Saturday Frights.
You built a Stargate portal. Projectionist, how is this even real? Where does it lead?
It is a portal to the Haunted Drive-In, naturally. From there, we can contact the Retroist. Warn him to use the Omega Protocol.
Wait.
Let me help
Stop
you.
Stop pushing! Projectionist, no!
I'll be right behind you!
Projectionist?
You okay there, son? Did you trip on the gravel and lean your head against one of the speakers? You look mighty peaked.
Oh, what?
Where's your car at? Did you catch the bus and walk all the way out here?
Where's the projectionist? He should be behind me.
What are you talking about, Todd? You are the projectionist.
My name's not Todd, it's Vic Sage.
Unless you have a twin, son. Your name is Todd. Todd Browning. We made that deal, remember? Back in Chicago. It's me, Bill. Bill Darnell. Let me be the first to welcome you officially to Starlight Starbright Family Fun Drive-In, Todd. Or should I call you Head Projectionist?
Oh, boy.
And now, on with the show.
Now come this way, Todd. Normally, the concession staff will show up around 4 p.m. That gives them plenty of time to warm up the popcorn machine, brew lots of fresh coffee, and get those tasty hot dogs and hamburgers prepped. I figured, since we agreed you could live in the basement, that you can let the staff in when they show up.
Yeah, I can do that.
Now, back here, through these swinging doors, is where all the magic takes place. To your right is my office. We are all one big family here at the Starlight Starbright Family Fun Drive-In, son. My door is always open. But remember your manners and knock before entering. You hear me?
Yes, sir.
That's quite enough of that, sir, pish-posh, Todd. I'm Bill. You can even call me Big Bill, if that suits your fancy. That right there is the employee facilities. As you can plainly see, it has all the amenities. Health department folks made sure of that. My goodness, whatever's the matter, son?
In the bathroom mirror, my face!
What's wrong with it, Todd?
It's not... nothing. Nothing.
I think it might be a good idea if we take you down to the basement. Let you put that heavy suitcase down. Get yourself settled for tonight's presentation.
You might be right, Mr. Darnell. Bill.
Now listen here, Todd. If you were feeling under the weather, you just let me know, okay? You might be catching something. Maybe that trip from Chicago has worn you a mite down. I can run the projection booth tonight if it comes down to it. What kind of a manager would I be if I wasn't afraid to get my hands dirty?
A murdering kind, Victor!
Now, Todd, you need to nip all of that yelling, son. I'm starting to worry about you.
Get a hold of yourself, Sage. Don't make him suspicious.
I'm sorry, Bill. I suppose I don't feel quite myself.
I understand, Todd. Haddonfield is a far cry from the bustling likes of Chicago. We can talk after you rest and freshen up a bit.
Thank you, Bill.
Absolutely my pleasure, Todd. Now remember, my office is just down the hall there. If you need anything, give me a shout.
I will, Bill. Thanks again. What's going on, projectionist? Why does everyone think I'm you?
Something must have gone wrong with the portal. I was afraid it wasn't stable enough for two souls to pass through. It would seem that I was quite correct on that matter. Perhaps I wasn't using enough Hand of Glory in conjunction with the portal.
Why do I look like you, though? Before the incident with the fire, I mean. Are we back in the Haunted Drive-In's past?
Wouldn't you say that is an obvious yes? Remember, though, it's the Starlight Starbright Family Fun Drive-In. You don't want Bill to start getting suspicious. Passing through the portal has merged us, obviously. Sadly, however, it would seem that you are the dominant personality in this case. Just my luck, stuck in the passenger seat of your mind. Until I can figure a way out of this.
Is there some way we can open the portal back up and get back home?
Keep your voice down. It might take a bit of doing to get a suitable portal rebuilt. Parts that are required are not so readily available in this time. Victor, look at the briefcase.
The recording light is on. Projectionist? I don't understand how, but I think we're still broadcasting. Let me see if I can't raise the retroist or someone back at the vault.
That's absurd, Victor. The vault hasn't even been built at this point.
Attention, everyone. I regret to inform you that the retroist vault has fallen. Please do not return to the vault until you receive the all-clear code. Thank you, and have a nice day.
You were saying, projectionist? There are those who would say that the two of us passing through a Stargate portal and being merged into one is the epitome of absurd. At least you didn't blow up the retroist vault. We might be able to communicate with those back in our time. That's a good thing, right? Maybe we can raise Daniel 13 or others. Perhaps they can find a way to reach us. I guess our main task is for me to pretend to be you. I sure get a bad vibe from Bill.
As well you should. You really have no idea what he is capable of.
Do we need to be worried about the time continuum?
The what?
Come on, projectionist. In every time travel movie, you have to be careful about altering the past, right?
Those are just movies, Sage. I have no idea what would happen if we step on a butterfly in this time. But to play it safe, though, we're fortunate enough that you were trained as a projectionist at that Razorback Theater. Still, I might have to give you a little help with getting the films prepared and ready.
Okay. Hey, to pass the time, I guess we can still do the show, right? The briefcase has access to all the Retroist Vault films. Those guys at Q-Branch do good work.
I suppose our broadcast can continue. It'll help you from getting too bored without all your beep-boop games. Assuming that the future undead Darnell hasn't destroyed the Retroist Vault's antenna.
If he did, we wouldn't be getting the Retroist Emergency Channel. So I guess the listeners are still out there. Boy, this must sound like a weird direction for this show.
Prepare yourself, Sage. We're indeed pilgrims in an unholy land. Now, come, let us get to work.
Let me turn this off. Conserve the power just in case. What film are we showing tonight?
Why, Village of the Damned. And then, G.I. Blues.
Hello? Hello? Is anybody there? Alright. Now we can get some work done.
Anthea? I find myself asleep on the floor. What an extraordinary thing to do.
I'm cold.
Well, the speaker from the projection booth works. I'll have to get used to starting that second projector with the second reel of the film.
It will come to you easily enough. I assure you.
Bill sure was hovering over us up there. I didn't think he was ever going to leave us alone.
Bill Darnair is a crafty one. Although, it was probably your shrill cries of alarm every 5 seconds earlier that worried him.
Sorry. Not every day I find I'm stuck in someone else's body.
Imagine how I feel.
Sorry, projectionist. So, the first film you showed at this drive-in was 1960's Village of the Damned?
Yes. A fine film. Wolf Willer directed an engaging adaptation of John Wyndham's 1957 novel. Wolf Willer delivered a tight bit of horror with science fiction overtones. Why, he even co-wrote the screenplay with Sterling Sillivant and Ronald Kinnock.
It's truly a chilling tale. A slowly building sense of dread, Wolf really managed to continually tighten the screws, so by the end of it, you're kind of worn out. I can remember seeing it for the first time, thanks to the TBS Sunday afternoon movie. Made a real impression on me, to say the least. I think I secretly wanted the powers of those strange children of Midwich. Actually, I would have just settled for making my eyes glow.
Did you know, Victor, that in the original British cut of the film, the one widely seen for many years in the United Kingdom, did not have those special effects applied to the children's eyes?
No, I didn't. So in the American release, they added that effect.
Indeed. It appears that the studio heads at Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer felt that the children using their abilities without a visual cue would be overlooked by audiences in America as well as other countries. The effect of the children's eyes was created by matting a negative image over the pupils when they used their powers.
That makes me want to see the original cut, Projectionist. Compare the two.
I have a personal print in the Retro's vault. I don't let those eggheads from the Retro's labs digital whatchamacallit. However, you might have to wait a bit until you can see it, eh?
We can talk about some of the more notable trivia after the synopsis. Village of the Damned's story concerns the small English village of Midwich, a sleepy little rural town that experiences something bizarre one morning. At 11 a.m. sharp, the entire village, and I mean every man, woman, child, dog, sheep, and cow, everything falls unconscious at the same time. Now, just before all of this happened, we meet two of our main protagonists. Professor Gordon Zellaby, played by the Jungle Book's George Saunders, and his brother-in-law, Major Alan Bernard, played by The Revenge of Frankenstein's Michael Gwynn. The two are talking on the phone just seconds before whatever knocks out all the citizens of Midwich. This, of course, worries Alan, and after he spends a bit of time trying to get anyone on the phone, he decides to go see what the situation is. On his drive to Midwich, just before entering the town proper, he meets a constable on a bike who has been sent himself because a bus has gone missing. Alan hasn't driven very far at all before he slams on his brakes. We, the viewers, can see just a little further up the road. There is the bus, off to the side of the road where it has come to a stop against a fence. Within, the inhabitants are all passed out. The constable quickly approaches the bus, but as he gets near, he too just falls unconscious. Alan is quick to head back to the nearest town and call his military supervisor. And before you know it, they are cordoning off the road, as well as a good deal of space around the entire village. Anyone that passes a line they've placed on the ground falls asleep, even if they're wearing a gas mask. So whatever's occurring isn't chemical. Thankfully, the soldier that is the test subject for this has a rope attached to his waist, so they can pull him back, where he was woken and is perfectly fine, except for his complaints of being terribly cold.
The military and the world is going to have much more to worry about soon enough. We should also add, Victor, that the area of effect that is rendering people unconscious includes those in the sky as well.
Alan is in radio contact with a reconnaissance airplane. He asks the pilot to fly lower to see if he can spy anything from above. He, of course, warns the man that if he starts to feel strange, to immediately pull up. The pilot reports that he can see many of the citizens of Midwich just laying on the ground. There is no movement in the village.
Too bad for the pilot that when he descends a little lower, the effect is so quick that he passes out. And Alan, as well as the rest of the military, can only watch helplessly as the plane crashes in a fiery explosion.
I also want to say that I really liked how Michael Gwynn really sells the anguish and guilt over the pilot's death. Alan is quick to have all aircraft radioed away from Midwich to avoid another crash.
No worries there. As just a few seconds later, they are all witness to a cow in the field awakening, followed by the passengers on that bus, as well as the constable.
Exactly. Every person and animal, etc., are waking up exactly at the same time. I know we said we were going to get to the interesting bits of trivia after the synopsis, but I want to point out that constable is none other than Peter Vaughn, who Game of Thrones fans might recognize as Master Aemon. Anyway, every inhabitant of Midwich is experiencing the same cold feeling as the soldier did earlier, including Professor Zellaby, who we learn is married. As Anthea, played by the beautiful Barbara Shelley, enters the room reporting that she fell asleep in the other room. Her husband is quick to explain he too fell asleep. They're worried even more when they happen to spy the clock above the fireplace and realize they've both lost almost 4 hours.
The even bigger shock, dear listeners, comes 2 months later.
Everyone has kind of accepted the unexplained unconsciousness as a bizarre circumstance. But very quickly, they learn that every woman in the village that is capable of bearing a child is in fact pregnant. The filmmakers wisely decide to show us various households throughout the village and how they're reacting to this news. For example, Jimmy, who has just returned home from the Navy, where he's been gone for a year, is none too happy to learn his wife is pregnant. In fact, while it's not said, you get the feeling that maybe Jimmy thinks his wife and his brother have been up to something. The town's doctor, however, is the first to realize something is quite wrong when all of the women show signs of being impregnated on the same day, exactly 2 months ago. So, he brings in Professor Zellaby, who a month ago was ecstatic at the news he was going to be a father. You see, Gordon is quite a bit older than Anthea, and they assumed they would never have children. You can imagine how alarmed he is when the doctor brings him along for a chat with Midwich's vicar.
An attempted suicide. Janet Paul, whose husband only came back from sea yesterday.
It's dreadful, dreadful.
Three other women in the village half out of their minds. Millie Hughes, Rose Shepherd, and Mary Burnett.
Please don't go.
That's why we're asking you to tell us, vicar.
Please don't keep on. I know these girls. I've watched them grow up. And when they tell me that they have no way of accounting for their condition, well, I'm compelled to believe them.
That means that every woman in this village who is capable of childbirth is going to have a baby.
I can't believe it.
This is not a matter of belief, vicar. It's a matter of fact. And there's something else. All this seems to date from that day 2 months ago when Midwich was cut off from the rest of the world.
We are getting ahead of ourselves, but this is exactly why MGM shelved the film for a couple of months after completion. They totally wanted to make sure the public wasn't going to freak out on what would be, well, in some cases for the characters, virgin births. There are more surprises in store for the pregnant women of Midwich. For example, how quickly the children are growing within them. And you probably already know how the delivery is going to go, listeners. All the children are born on the very same day. All just a little over 10 pounds, with, quote, arresting eyes, end quote. All with platinum blonde hair and narrow fingernails.
But the strangeness doesn't end there, eh? The children grow at a rapid rate. And if one learns something, the others immediately gain that knowledge.
Exactly. The children of Midwich have telepathic abilities, which is demonstrated in a horrible moment at the Zellaby house, when Gordon enters the kitchen to find his wife thrusting her hand over and over again in agony into a pot of boiling water. Why? The milk she had just given their child David was too hot, so he's punishing her for her mistake. The film then jumps to 3 years later, and we find ourselves in a military meeting with British intelligence, because there's just too much weirdness going on in Midwich for this to go unnoticed. The Zelebes learn that Midwich wasn't the only place affected by that strange phenomenon. The children, by the way, are acting far older than 3 years old. They look to physically be 7 or 8 years old. They dress exactly the same, always travel in a group, speak in a mature, emotionless fashion. And David, it would seem, is their leader. The military decide, after a few accidents in the village, that the children should be taught by Professor Zelebe, kept away from the other children and the other townsfolk, which is how we learn some frightening facts.
By the way, just how deep do you see into my mind?
Everything that's in the front of your mind.
The thought processes? The reasoning that leads to my spoken words?
We still have to master that. It'll come.
Well, that's frank. Thank you, David. At least I still have some privacy. Now, the question I want to ask is this. Are you aware of life on another planet? Why are you so nervous when an aircraft flies above you?
You're very observant, Father.
Yes, but that doesn't answer my question.
All right. Until recently, we haven't been able to make our control reach as far as a high aircraft.
Well, now you have, is that it?
What are you going to do with that power?
Father, we know what you're trying to find out. It'd be better if you didn't ask these questions. We want to learn from you.
Now why would these children want to control airplanes, eh?
Things begin to come to a head when the children start using that ability we saw earlier in the film between David and his mother. For example, when Jimmy's brother almost runs over one of the children by accident, the kids gather together and force him to drive his car at high speed and smash against a wall, killing him. Later on, Jimmy decides to get vengeance on the children by shooting them with a shotgun. Professor Zelebe is able to talk some sense into the man. And as Jimmy is heading home, David and the others, who have picked up on his murderous thoughts, force him to turn the shotgun upon himself.
Shockingly, after watching his son and the other children murder Jimmy, Professor Gordon Zelebe believes he can still reach them. Teach the little monsters something of humanity.
Like the projectionist just stated, Gordon still believes he can save the children of Midwich. He mentions that their willpower was like trying to break through a brick wall. That statement will become very important, as even Gordon is finally forced to admit that the children, even his son David, are quite inhuman. The professor decides to do something valiant. He sees now that he can't allow the children to escape, to eventually reproduce and take over the Earth. So, when he goes to teach the kids next, he brings something special in his satchel.
A time bomb!
Professor Zelebe, to protect his thoughts from being seen by the children, imagines a wall, a brick wall, hiding his intended actions. Of course, the children sense this and begin using their mental might to hammer at the imaginary wall that Gordon has placed. Until, near the last second when the professor can't resist anymore, the alien children of Midwich display their first emotion, shock, as the time bomb explodes and consumes all within.
Professor Gordon Zelebe dies as a hero, saving Midwich and possibly the Earth. If similar actions are taking place around the world, but most importantly, he has put a stop to the village of the damned.
That is the full synopsis for the film, friends. We've got a bit of interesting trivia to talk about. When it was originally being cast back in 1957, the studio wanted Lost Horizons' Ronald Coleman to play the role of Gordon Zelebe. Sadly, Coleman passed away in 1958, and in 1959, when George Saunders got the part, he was married to Coleman's widow, Benita Hume.
Dear listeners, You might want to know that the map coordinates for Midwich, which are given over the radio after Alan warns off all aircraft, refer to the wildlife village of Woodwincott in Hampshire.
Even though MGM was worried how audiences would react to the film, it proved to be an absolute sleeper hit. So much so that in 1963, they released a sequel entitled Children of the Damned. Although in this film, the children are more benevolent in nature, up to a point when they are threatened, and then they turn their abilities upon the military. I guess we should jump into the notable cast and crew, Projectionist.
Not so fast. You're forgetting the 1995 remake by John Carpenter.
I just figured we'd talk about it on another show. Now, director Wolf Rilla passed away on October 19th, 2005. He had 29 directing credits to his name, with the likes of 1953's Noose for a Lady, 1954's The Black Rider, 1959's Witness in the Dark, and The Scarlet Baroness, and even a 1965 episode of The Avengers entitled The Murder Market. George Saunders passed away sadly by his own hand on April 25th, 1972. He had earned 135 acting credits, with notable roles in 1939's The Saint Strikes Back. Yes, he had the honor of portraying that dashing thief, Simon Templar, in 5 feature films. He also portrayed the popular movie sleuth, The Falcon, in 5 films starting in 1941. He is also known for his work in 1945's film adaptation of The Picture of Dorian Gray, 1947's The Ghost and Mrs. Muir, 1950's All About Eve, and he even was the villainous Mr. Freeze in 2 episodes of the 1966 Batman TV series. Michael Gwynn passed away on January 29, 1976, with 88 acting credits. Notable roles in films and TV include 1963's Cleopatra, as well as Jason and the Argonauts. He appeared in 8 episodes of The Queen Street Gang, as well as making an appearance in a 1969 episode of The Avengers. Michael was also in 1970's Scars of Dracula, and one of his last roles was in a 1975 episode of Fawlty Towers as Lord Melberry. I think that about wraps up this episode. On behalf of the Projectionist and myself, we thank you for listening to the Saturday Frights podcast. If you did enjoy the show, we hope you hop on over to The Retroist every Saturday, where we present everything from classic horror TV shows to the best in frightening shorts. The music you normally hear at the beginning of the show is provided by Peachy. If you'd like to contact him, you may do so at peachy@retroist.com. Our ending theme is entitled Twisted Toys and was composed by the talented Tony Longworth. You can listen to even more of his music on SoundCloud and on his official site, which you can reach at www.tonylongworth.com. If you are new to our show, we do have a Saturday Frights Facebook page, and we'd greatly appreciate it if you could stop by and give us a like, or even let others know about it. It's another spot where we can share our love of retro horror with you, and not have to wait until Saturday to do so. The podcast is available on iTunes and Stitcher, and I can be found nearly every day on The Retroist. If you have any suggestions for future shows, or even feedback, you can contact me at VicSage@Retroist.com. We owe a great debt of gratitude to the Retroist himself for letting us start this show. When you have retro needs, and we all do, just head over to www.retroist.com. Until next time, friends, remember to replace your car speakers on its post before leaving the drive-in, as we play a clip from the subject of our next show.
Walk to a thorny through no fault of your own. But as the rain enters the soil, the river enters the sea, so tears run to a predestined end. Your suffering is over, Bale, my son. Now you will find peace.
This has been a Retroist production. Goodbye.